data they do not provide for appropriate classification of disease group other than those on the basis of race, gender, and disability, and fail to account for need-based restitution. Solidarity sought an order confirming the finding of the recommendation made in the quality report, insofar as they relate to employment equity. And they submitted that the equality report had binding effect because of its sexual existence. Next slide, please. Now, the Labour Court, the application by Solidarity in the Labour Court was dismissed on the following reasons. The court said no statutory or other regulatory provision that renders the equality report binding on government or any other party, said there was no reason for the court, for the department, to follow this report. The South African Human Rights itself did not intend the report to be binding. The report is a research report intended to encourage to the public discourse and to provide advice and guidance to government in fulfilling its constitutional obligation. No basis on which the court was empowered to confirm or otherwise enforce the report's finding and recommendation for purposes sought by Solidarity or for any other purpose. And Solidarity has not sought to postpone that part of the application in which it seeks to declare Section 42 of the Act unconstitutional. The Labour Appeal Court application was dismissed, and then they went to the Constitutional Court. The application was also dismissed for leave to appeal by both the Labour Appeal Court, the Labour Court, and the Constitutional Court. Next slide, please. Now, as members would know, in terms of government processes, all legislation that are going through government processes must go through what we call a SEER process on any government proposed bill, amendment, bill, or policy. The government process conducted by the Department of Planning and Monitoring and Evaluation, and this process, as I indicated, is not conducted by the department concerned. In this case, Department of Employment and Labor, is conducted by DPME. Before the bill can be tabled in any cluster, cabinet, for approval, the bill must be published or public for public comment for tabling in Parliament. A CSA must be done, and the Department of Monitoring and Planning must ensure that the bill or the policy cover all areas that they needed to cover, that it does not affect the economy negatively. And DPME has a standard template to do this work, which each department must complete on each bill to enable assessment and certification of the bill. And the CSA report certification is then included together with the bill for tabling in both the cluster, the DG cluster, and also the cabinet before any approval can be granted. There is no legal requirement to publish the CSA report for public comment, but in relation to the E-Amendment bill, the CSA was conducted twice before the bill was published for public comment in 2018. And again, after incorporation in the bill, the public comments and NEDLAC social partners. Next slide, please. And the objective of this is to minimize unintended consequences from policy initiative, regulation, and legislation, including unnecessary costs from implementation and compliance, as well as from unanticipated outcomes, and anticipate implementation risk and encourage measures to mitigate them. The policymakers are required to assess the likely impact of the policy, regulation, or law, or all other four conditions that are required, that is, social cohesion, safety, food, financial and energy, economic inclusion, economic growth, and environmental sustainability. Next slide, please. Now, members, the consultation process on the bill started with the proposed amendment that we were first discussed in the advisory sent to the minister by the Employment Commission in 2017, which consists of representatives from NEDLAC social partners, business, labor, and community. The amendment bill was then tabled at NEDLAC in 2017, and deliberated on the bill. The deliberation of the bill was finalized in 2018. The bill was published for public comment for 60 days in September 2018, followed by initial public hearings, which were held in all provinces in 2018 in 9 provinces. Interdepartmental deliberation on the amendment on the bill commenced on the 29th with the National Treasurer, the Office of the Chief Procurement, DTI, in terms of BBBE Policy Unit, DMR, in terms of the Mining Charter, the Department of Higher Education, in terms of higher education institutions, CCMA, the linkage between the CCMA case management system and the employment equity system for verification to ensure ensuring of compliance certificates, and the Department of Employment Standards linkage between the Act and the National Minimum Wage Exemption System. The EE verification process, ensuring of compliance, and followed by stakeholder engagement on setting sector EE targets, which are still in progress. Next slide, please. Now, the following areas, in terms of the changes that we intend to do, and the so-called social the definition of deserted employees, Section 15 of Employment Equity Act, Section 15 Capital A of the Amendment Bill, Section specific targets versus quotas, reasonable progress versus justifiable reason grounds. That is a court case that we are going to take to the next member. Section 53(6) of the Amendment Bill. Corruption versus compliance certificate and compliance certificate versus procedural law. Next slide, please. We've already dealt with this one. Can we move? Next one, please. The amendment bill is intended to reduce the regulatory administrative burden on submission of EE report by small employers. That is those companies that employ less than 50 employees. And the changes in this section is that they do not have to comply with they do not have to comply with Chapter 3 of the Act, implementation of affirmative action. That's the section that they need. They don't need to have to comply. In order for small employers to obtain the certificate of compliance, they must comply with the following requirements. Chapter 2 of the Act, unfair discrimination, therefore they cannot discriminate unfairly, and the national minimum wage. They don't have to submit reports to the department when this law is passed. The only issue that they must do, as we said, they must not discriminate, and they must comply with the national minimum wage. And those are the only two questions that are asked from small employers for them to get a certificate of compliance. And it changes, it makes it easy for those employers to do business with government and other employers, because now they don't have to submit reports, just like these employers at these companies. Next slide, please. Section 51 of the Act states that affirmative measures are measures designated to ensure that suitable qualified people from deserted groups with equal employment opportunities are equally represented in all occupational levels in the workplace, in the workforce of a designated employer. Section 52 states that affirmative action measures implemented by the designated employer must include measures to identify and eliminate employment barriers, including unfair discrimination, which adversely affects people from designated groups. Measures designed to further diversity in the workplace based on equality, dignity, and respect for all people, making reasonable accommodation for people from designated groups in order to ensure that they enjoy equal opportunities and are equitably represented in the workforce of a designated employer. That's what Section 52(15)(2) states of the Act. Next slide, please. Subsection 3 continues indicating that to ensure the equitable representation of suitable qualified people from dated groups in all occupational levels in the workforce and retain and develop people from dated grouping and to implement appropriate training measures, including measures in terms of an act of parliament providing for skill development. Section 15(3) states that the measures referred to in subsection 2D include preferential treatment and numerical goals, but exclude quotas. Now, this is important, members, because the targets that we are setting, there are people who are arguing that we intend to set quotas, and we want to show why these targets are not quotas. Subject to Section 42, nothing in the section requires the native employer to take any decision concerning an employment policy or practice that would establish an absolute barrier to the prospective or continued employment or advancement of people who are not from designated grouping. The law does not prevent employment of white men, for example, because they are not designated. And that's what Section 42 precisely states. Next slide, please. Section 51 states that the minister may, by not using the government assets, identify national economic sectors for the purpose of this act, having regard to any relevant code contained in the standard industrial classification of the economic activity published by the State of South Africa. Section 52, capital A, indicates that the minister may prescribe criteria that must be taken into account in identifying sectors and subsectors for the purpose of this section. In Section 53, capital A, 15, capital A, 3, the minister may, after consulting the minimum wage commission for the purpose of ensuring the equitable representation of suitably qualified people from designated group in all occupational levels in the workforce by noticing the government that set numerical targets for national economic sector identified in subsection 1. Now, the proposed amendment in Section 15A, capital 3, reads, the minister may, after consulting the relevant sector with the advice of the Commission of Employment Equity for the purpose of ensuring that equitable representation of suitable, the new section there, honorable members, is that the minister may, after consulting the relevant sectors and with the advice of the Commission of Employment Equity, this section was inserted in the bill that was published by the minister after the discussion in the portfolio committee. For purpose of ensuring the equitable representation of suitably qualified people from desert grouping of all occupational levels in the workforce, by noticing the government gazette, set numerical targets for any national economic sector identified in terms of subsection 1. Next slide, please. Now, to give effect to Section 15, capital A3 in the bill and the NEDLAC agreement in relation to consultation with the sector stakeholders for the setting of sector-specific targets below is the progress made in terms of this. Members, the sector stakeholder consultation commenced in June 2019 with interdepartmental engagement in the National Treasury, with the National Treasury and others, and on the 31st of March, a total of 16 of economic sectors have been consulted, 2 sector outstanding, manufacturing and public administration sector consultation, we're still continuing with them. Details of the sector stakeholder consultation is contained in slide 31, as we indicated. Next slide, please. Now, Section 15, capital A, a notice issued in terms of this section may set different numerical targets for different occupational levels, subsectors, regions within a sector on the basis of any other relevant sector. Section 15A, a draft of any notice that the minister proposed to issue in terms of Section 1, subsection 3, must be published in the Government Gazette, allowing for parties for 30 days. Now, minister, we, honorable members, included comments that were made by parties which were raising that 30 days is not enough, and our view was that these comments that were made in the bill, the 30 days for comments in the NEDLAC agreement and again published for proposed effect, that would be outcome of the agreement reached with the relevant stakeholders and sectors during the sector consultation. Next slide, please. The issues of quotas versus targets. Members, in our view, quotas are mandatory. If we set a quota, you've got to apply with it. But targets are aspirational goals. And quotas are rigid, but targets are flexible, but must be must be followed. Quotas have got penalties instituted for missed outcomes. The flexibility already built into the draft regulation and the justifiable reason of the law allow the targets to be flexible. Next slide, please. Now, flexibility in this is built in two ways. Members, employers have power to set their own annual EE targets in their own EE plan through consultation with employees, trade unions, in terms of Section 16, the Act, on the Act towards achieving the regulation setting targets. Therefore, what we're saying is that employers have the power to set their own annual targets. Although we are going to be setting over 3 to 5 years usual targets, employers will be able to say how they will reach those targets. And if an employer says, if we say a target is 50% or 50% in 3 years, then the employer can say, in the first year I'll be 20%, in the second year I'll be 40%, then in the third year I'll be 100%. That's the flexibility that is built in the setting of targets and in the regulation. And in terms of the regulation also has got a provision that states that the justifiable reason grounds for not complying with the target include. Therefore, the employer can say, well, although there's a target and I've set up my annual target, I have not been able to comply with this target because of this reason. And these are the list of justifiable reasons that an employer can cite: court order, transfer business, merger, insufficient recruitment, all of those issues. And that's why we're saying these are not quotas because they are flexible. And in light of the above, as members are saying, the discussion on flexibility is clear that the targets that we intend to set are not quotas because of the flexibility built in the regulation and in the application of this target. Next slide, please. Now, the Section 53.6, which enabled the minister to be able to issue a certificate in terms of subsection 2, if the minister certified that the employer has complied with the numerical target set in subsection 15A, in respect of any target which the employer has not complied with, the employer has raised a reasonable ground to justify its failure to comply as complicated by section 42.4. Therefore, if the employer says, I've got a justifiable reason not to comply, the employer will get a certificate. The employer submitted a report, the employer must submit a report, and there has been no funding by the CCMA or a court within the previous 1 year. The act, the law, that's what the law says, the bill that's in front of you, the original bill said 3 years, was changed in the Constitutional Committee to indicate 1 year, that the employer breached the provision on unfair discrimination. The CCMA has not issued a warrant against the employer on minimum wage, that the employer in the last 12 months has complied with the minimum wage and paid the minimum wage. Now, if you answer all these questions positively, then you'll be able, as an employer, to get a certificate. Next slide, please. Now, the process of issuing those certificates, and there was this issue that the certificate is going to create corruption in the department because of corruption, inspectors or officials of the department will sell certificates. Now, our view on this certificate are done on automation. That's like they will operate the same way as the tax. If you supply your tax information to SARS, it's done online. Everything is done online. If you supply the information, you get the response immediately. The annual assessment of targets, it's easy to save, print and email the certificate. The system will be linked to the CCMA case management and the National Minimum Wage Exemption System to ensure back-end verification process with the CCMA accreditation award for discrimination cases and to check if employers have been exempted from paying the National Minimum Wage. No manual certificate will be issued. All of this is done by the system. Small employers will be able to be issued with the submission on request. Next slide, please. And there's no other compliance requirements with other laws outside procurement which are currently prohibited. Now, there was a comment that was made, members were raising these issues before, members when they applied their minds on this bill, they know what were the comments that were made, the issue around SAR certificate, the B certificate. Now, the E amendment proposal is an F on the certificate. And then we argued that the rationale why Section 53 of the Act was not promulgated in 1998 with the Section of Employment Equity Act, the employers required time to develop and implement systems and processes to comply with the requirements of the Act, each establishing data systems to collect workforce data, conduct workforce analysis. There was no tool and criteria to place to assess compliance, including regulation and system to issue certificate compliance under Section 53. Now the tools and criteria developed in the 99.9 of e-reports are submitted online. We think, therefore, we are ready to promulgate Section 53. Next slide, please. Now, the issues of law enforcement versus corruption, some parties raised a concern about labor inspectors, authority care officers. We all concede that we live in an environment where corruption and bribery is rife, but we cannot stop law enforcement only based on fears and corruption. And we must all deal with two parties involved in the corruption, that the corruptor and the receiver. And the system that we're putting in place are going to be able to deal with this. And we said, because the certificate is printed by the employer, the employer gives the report, they print the certificate by themselves, they don't have to ask the inspector for anything. Therefore, we must continue with enforcement of the law. Both laws and criminal laws must be enforced if anybody is doing anything wrong. Next slide, please. Now, Section 53, considering the presentation that was given to include consultation relevant sectors, if you look at the original bill that was presented in Parliament, it did not have this provision for consultation. Now, with the comment that was made in the control committee, we included the issue of consultation with stakeholders, and we, if you look on the original bill, also it talks about any other person who considered that this issue must be taken away. I've already dealt with the issues of 12 months and three years, that the bill present in front of you members talks to 12 months, no more 3 years. Next slide, please. The following sector, the sector BU code that we've looked at in terms of setting the targets, the list starting from agriculture, public administration, real estate, information, construction and mining are all sectors that have what we call BBBE charters that we look on in terms of setting these targets. Next slide, please. Now, the consultation process with relevant stakeholders, in June 2019, the Department and the Commission of Employment, we started the consultation with all stakeholders to precisely to deal with setting of targets and so a top management senior, professionally qualified and skilled. Notwithstanding that the promulgation of the Act is still underway in Parliament, as I've indicated, we decided to take a principal decision to continue started the process of consultation. Next slide, please. Now, these are the dates of consultation that were set up that we've been consulting the parties. I'm not going to go through. Next slide, please. The last issue, Chair, that we think we need to raise, we've raised this issue at the protocol committee, and we're raising it here, that there's a section that was not amended in this Act, Section 42 of the Act, that we want to ask the members of the committee to see whether can we amend this section. If you read Section 32 as it stands now, it says anybody who's applying this Act must take into consideration both regional and national demographics. Now, the problem that we've had over the years is that you cannot take into consideration both. You either take one area or you take the other. And the members would know there was a court case here in Cape Town with the Department of services where correctional services use the national demographic instead of the provincial demographic. Now, we want that area, although it's not in the bill members raising it, we want that area to be changed so that it reads, instead of saying and, we replace and with all. We know that this amendment was not published, it's not part of this, and that we're putting in front of the committee, because if it's not corrected, it says you must use national and regional demographic. It means you must use both of them. Now, it's impossible to use both of them, and that's what the Act has been all along. And the bill that was passed by Cabinet had that change in, but unfortunately, the bill that ended up in Parliament submitted to us did not have that change from national or regional. And we're putting this in front of the committee to see whether can we change that normality so that the Act and can operate properly. And both business and labor at NEDLAC on this accept this change, because it will make it easier for employers to choose one of the two, either national demographic or national demographic, instead of having to use both. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mkhaliti, for the presentation on the employment equity. First, before we ask members to make comments, can we get comments from our legal unit, Ms. Isaac, and the Office of the State Law Advisor?
Thank you, Chairperson. At this stage, I don't have any comments. I will be led by the committee if there's any specific issues or questions that they require clarity.
Okay. Office of State Law of Guide.
Good afternoon, Chair, and good afternoon, honourable members. At this stage, we have nothing to add, Chairperson.
As both of you, can you advise then on the point that the last point that Mr. Mkhaliti is raising? Because when the bill is going to be advertised, it will be without this particular area on Section 42. What will be the implication of that? I'm not saying as a committee you may not deliberate and come up with an amendment. But it will disadvantage the public, because it will not be part of the bill that goes out to the public. If you can, both of you advise on that. Or if you want to advise at a later stage, you are free to do so. Ms. Isaac.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we will just have to consider how we communicate this issue to the public, because it was not before the portfolio committee for most of until the end, and it didn't officially serve before the committee. So at this stage, we'll have to probably consider whether we, you know, note it in the advert, or we alert the people who have made submissions of this proposal, because we don't have any public comment on this particular issue. And it will not necessarily be compliant with our processes if we don't get comments on something that is going to be, has possible implications for various stakeholders.
No, that's why we would like you to advise us then, because we will be advertising, but the advert will refer people to the bill. And when they look at the bill, it doesn't have that particular issue on Section 42. So how is it going to be published? Because the bill itself that will be out to the public won't have it. How do you then insert it? Because you can't insert it if it was not adopted by the, unless then it comes from the public as part of the public involvement or hearing.
Yes, Chairperson, that is the difficulty. Maybe we could just have time to consult the committee section as to how we could approach this, or we could have an approach from the institution as to what is the best way to deal with this matter, because we are concerned about the legal implications. So if you can just give us some time to consult on the matter before we give the committee some reasoned advice.
Okay. No, that's what I think that the Office of the State Law Advisor would be also concur.
Chairperson, I think that the parliamentary law advisor is best placed to advise on the procedure with regard to with the bills and publications in Parliament, but if needs be, we are willing to consult with the parliamentary law advisors when they prepare the response for the committee.
Okay. No, thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, can we ask questions on the presentation? Can I just, before again, sorry, we have various, the number of documents that were sent to us. We have the PowerPoint presentation, but we also had the bill amended by the portfolio committee, but also we have the A bill. I'm not sure whether then the bill, let me just check the number at the bottom. The B14B, whether it already includes the amendments that are in the A list. Mr. Isaac?
Chairperson, the bill before the committee is the B bill. That was the bill adopted by the National Assembly. So that includes all the amendments agreed to by the portfolio committee and adopted by the National Assembly.
Okay, so we don't have to look at both the A list and the B bill.
No,
everything already accommodated there.
Yes, Chairperson, the B bill is sufficient for this meeting.
Okay, no doubt. Honourable members, can we have a question? Are there any hands or is the presentation clear? I'll have the hand of Honourable Boshoff. Honourable Maymark, I think we'll take Honourable Boshoff and Honourable Maymark for now. Over to you, Honourable Boshoff. Good afternoon.
Thank you very much, Chair. On behalf of the DA, I just would like to have it noted that the DA does not support this bill. And I can give you reasons for that. One of them is it will definitely see the minister misusing his powers. We will see the deterrent of investors. The economy will be undermined. We'll see the creation of extra job losses. We will see the increasing of unemployment. It currently stands at an expanded rate of 44.4%. And there is just no way that the DA can go ahead and condone this bill. I would like to say that we are all for redressing the imbalances of the past, but it must be done in a constitutional manner. Then I would also like to say that it would appear, listening to the minister and to the presenter, that the concentration is on the upper echelons of the private sector. Why are we not looking at the public sector as well? Because it appears as if government is just turning a blind eye to the public sector, but just concentrating on the upper echelons of the private sector. And then I am completely against one person, and that is the Minister of Employment and Labour, having the opportunity to set EE targets. That is absolutely undemocratic and unconstitutional. And I also do not support the Section 42 as discussed. I would like to see it taken to the public for consultation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honourable Boshoff. I think what is going to happen is that now that we're getting the briefing on the Employment Equity Bill, we'll follow the processes. The bill will then be advertised so that the public could also make comments, written comments, but also oral presentation. Obviously, I'm sure it will be via Fetch, but because of the situation we find ourselves in. Then after that, we will consider the input from the public, and the department will also respond on the inputs from the public. And then as members will deliberate, that's when then the issues that the Honorable Boshoff is raising could come in. But when we finalize then the bill, we will vote on the bill as a committee, and then we take it to the House parties, because it's Section 75. Political parties will have an opportunity to make their declaration for or against. So that some of the points that the Honorable Boshoff is making would be more relevant when we do the declarations in the House. But there's some questions that need clarity that Mr. Mpalibu will have to respond to, particularly with regard to the public, I mean the public sector. There's a specific question with regard to the public sector. What is the role of the employment equity in the public sector? But before you respond, can I take Honorable Muima?
Thank you, Chair. Let me welcome the representation that's led by the Minister and the team on this brief relating to the amendment of the Employment Equity Plan. There are two areas that I encourage you on, Chair. The first one relates to the elaboration around the quota as against target. And the emphasis being that the target set is much more flexible. The reason why I seek this clarity is informed by the step on progress that you referred to. The beginning of the presentation, I think there were three to four slides that spoke to the progress that you are making and where we are feeling, and the regress that you are suffering in the last three years, 2018 up to now, which to me would definitely have invited a much more directive a role in terms of much more explicit wording, because in the current regress that we are suffering is probably informed by the flexibility that we have, and again we want to be a bit more diplomatic. It's a bit of a concern to me because the reality of the matter is that after 27 years, it cannot be correct that we still struggle with transformation in the public sector, particularly centered around issues that we raised. So I would invite the presenter just to be much more elaborate in terms of why this flexibility was just the next year, it has not delivered in the previous 7 years. The second one also, the justification that the employer could give, particularly when you juxtapose the directive by the as contemplated by Section 536, which is vis-à-vis Section 15A. To me, the fact that there's still room for employer to give justification as to why do they continue to not to meet the employment target, the challenge also in the sense that the issue of transformation cannot be postponed forever, and if the research and the survey and the numbers that we have put before us clearly indicate that there is a regress, and we continue again to then give employers more ample reason to justify as to why are they not in compliance with the Employment Equity Act. To me, it's a perpetuation of the delay that we continue to experience in terms of transforming both the public and the private sector. But more than that, to me the imperative of our daily business is writing the Constitution as across land and now are of paramount importance. And therefore it becomes important that any room, whether it is in the private sector, that continues to allow unfair discrimination must be stopped. And therefore, the bill is a work in progress in terms of ensuring that we are particularly given the fact that whether you go to education, which is a breeding ground sometimes for most of this discriminatory practices, you'll find that those that historically were advantaged continue to excel, because they do not have the legacy that we have in terms of skill shortage. And now, where there's an opportunity by the department to rectify, it cannot be correct to get a sense that there is still some of us who are trying to justify the perpetuation of the status quo. And the truth of the matter is that whether it is in employment, because the bill also raises a number of issues, whether it is the community checks that are also used sometimes to discriminate against the progression of those that historically were disadvantaged. It is important that such matters must be looked into, and I'm happy that the bill is into that. And therefore, it becomes important that this bill must be given an opportunity to reach its final conclusion as part and parcel of ruling our decision of the past. And it cannot be correct that even today, we still, as when we are addressing, and when we are correcting, even the progress that we have made, is suffering a blow. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mema. Are there any other members who want to... Zbele, can you please mute? Zbele, can you please mute? Are there any other members?
Honorable Chair?
Yes, Honorable Boshoff.
I'd just like to know, are we still at quorum?
No, we're not taking any decision, so the issue of quorum doesn't arise. It only arises when we are taking a decision. So this is a briefing. So a briefing can be done for one person or two people. So it's not it only arises when we go to take a decision. Then for Section 75, we need to give six provinces to meet the quorum for taking a decision. But there's no question to be asked. Only when we ask the question that we adopt the report or not. For now, it's a briefing. When we finalize the bill and we have to vote on it, we'll have to be six provinces, but it's Section 75. But for now, it's just a briefing. I hope that clarifies it. Okay. Are there any other members who would like to ask questions? If not, I would also like to ask some questions on the presentation. On close to Mr. Mkalipi, the Section 8 that has been amended. So I think the first point, before I go to this process, the presentation that we were making with regard to lack of progress in terms of the four occupational levels, not much progress. But then the question that is fundamental for me, whether the amendments that we will be making as the parliament, are they going to strengthen or make improvements on the implementation of the employment equity, particularly with regard to the economic active population, whether there will be more in terms of the percentages with regard to those four occupational categories. So that's a point I want to start with, so that we don't just make amendments for the sake of making amendments, but there is no impact with regard to the transformation, but in the workplace and also in the sector. The next question then is on clause 2, section 8, that talks to this particular amendment, its aim is to exclude the requirements that psychological testing and similar assessment of employees must be certified by the council. Say that the council does not have the capacity or procedures to undertake this certification, but therefore it leaves it. Therefore, the issue of evaluation is subject to by the Labour Court. My question would be that the Labour Court itself, in terms of the time period, because as you know, for example, with even other cases, it takes a long time for the Labour Court to decide on other cases, whether the dismissals and as well as other cases or termination. With regard then to these kind of cases of the testing, wouldn't we find ourselves in a situation where we have to wait for the Labour Court to find time? Shouldn't we rather capacitate maybe in a transitional period? I'm not saying that we do away with this selection, but then in a transitional period, we allow the council to get the capacity and also be able to set the procedures that are required so that it can meet these requirements. The other issue, I think, that is related to the occupational levels, not necessarily occupational levels, but also with regard to people with disabilities. I see that with regard to this other occupational level, it's got those categories of African male, African women, colored, males, the colored females, and so forth and so forth. My question would be, shouldn't we do the same also with regard to people with disabilities, so that we categorize, instead of just saying in 2018 it was 1%, now in 2020 it's 1.3, but we further categorize them in line with those occupational levels. I don't know if it's clear, but also using race and gender, even among the people with disabilities. Just wanted to ask that question. I'm sure this one of professionally qualified. My question would be also perhaps in both in the public schools and private schools. My clarity there, because I think this occupational level would qualify the professional qualified, because for me it will then refer to teachers, for example. But you find in the former models in schools that the teachers, the teaching profession in those schools is still really white. I don't know, maybe I haven't done a broader research, but I'm basing it on the schools that are attended by my own children, where if you find a black teacher, it will be one teacher who is only teaching Xhosa language. Other than that, you don't find any other teachers in schools. So perhaps it got to do with the whether this also apply these occupational levels and the targets and even quotas apply in schools, particularly former model C schools. The issue that was raised by Honorable Moimang, or I think the issue that deals with the target that the minister may be coming up with regard to economic sectors, whether they would also be able to improve the situation that we find ourselves in, the report that was just tabled with regard to those, most of those, if you compare, not compare with EAP, but just compare a year on year, you find that just between 2019 and 2020, less than a 1% increase in areas where there was an increase. I'm just basing it just on year to year, not necessarily on the EAP. I know that the focus should be on EAP, but I was just looking even year on year that there's no difference, like you were doing with the people with disabilities, that it was focusing on years, not necessarily on EAP. But I'm doing both, focusing on EAP as well as year on year. So that's what for me, I think, is a concern as well. But going back to the issue that was raised by Honorable Moimang, I think with regard to the Section 53, I think currently my understanding with the current Section 53 of the Act, if you say that in the bill, which has not yet been operationalized, I don't understand why it has not been operationalized, provide that the state contracts may only be issued to employers that have been certified as being in compliance with their obligation under the Act. Now, I'm not sure, therefore, whether the Clause 12, which seeks to amend Section 53 of the Act, whether it does away with this issuing of a contract to employers that have not been certified. If you can just clarify that, even if the amendments of subsection A, B, and C that Honorable Moimang is referring to, even if they remain, but if they remain, are they taking away that particular section that deals with the the state contracts that may not be issued to employers that have been that have not been certified, for example. If I could get clarity with regard to those particular issues. For now, I think thank you very much. If you could get a response, unless there are follow-up questions from other members before you respond. If not, can I ask you then to respond?
Thank you, Honourable Chair. The first question from Honourable Bosoff is why are we targeting the private sector, not government? The law applies to all sectors of the economy. We've taken a decision in this presentation to put steps in the private sector. We can give the committee the steps, same steps in the private sector. And you'll find out the private sector is doing far better than the government is doing far better than the private sector. Therefore, those steps, we can make them available. And the fact that we supply statistics in the private sector doesn't mean that the act does not apply to government. It does. And we can give the committee, before even the next meeting, those steps so that the committee can see that although in certain areas government is not where it should be, but it's doing far better than the private sector. On the question by Honorable Maimas is that we agree with all the issues that is stating here, that there has been no real movement in transformation of the labor market. There's no doubt about that. In the 21 years of employment decrease, the movement has been very slow. There's no doubt about that. But what we take into consideration in setting this regulation is we've got a constitutional perspective that we've got also to look at. If we set quotas, we know that this bill and this, when it becomes the act, if it passed by Parliament, there will be constitutional court challenges, and we should be able to defend this. And that's why we put in the provision, as we put it, that we're setting targets. Those targets must be met. If you can't meet those targets, you must have justifiable reason. Now, obviously, an employer would say, well, I've got justifiable reason. This is reason X. That makes me not to meet this target. Our inspectors, then, are expected to visit those companies, have a conversation with them. Let us say, if the company says, well, we could not meet this because the economy has not grown in our sector. The inspector must be able to go and say, well, let's show you other companies in your sector that have grown irrespective of what the economic situation is, and they've been able to transform. And that's the intention that we need to have in this, and that discussion. Obviously, if an employer does show a reason that is justifiable, that makes them not to be able to do what they need to do, it will be unwise of a law that says that irrespective of your justifiable reason, if you do not meet the target, you will face penalty. And that's the issue that we are pointing. Therefore, we agree the target has got to be strong, they've got to be enforced, they've got to be implemented, and the justifiable reason that are cited by employers must be derogated by all of us, our inspectors and us, to look at them. If we are not happy with that justifiable reason, we must be able to take them to court on those issues. And that's the reason, Honorable Norman, we take this approach. First, to make sure that we are able to defend if it's the active challenge in the constitutional court, in any court. Secondly, we accept that if the reason is justifiable, it would be unfair for us to act negatively to that employer if we accept the risk that they could justify a reason on it. So that's the only reason why we've taken this route in setting this target and not gone through the quota route, because we know clearly that if we set up quotas, the constitutional court challenge, and we are not going to be able to defend the law. But if we set targets and we can show whoever challenges it in court that our targets are flexible, if an employer has got a justifiable reason, because the law and the constitution says you can't penalize an employer that has got justifiable reason for not doing something, unless you can show that their justifiable reason is not justifiable after all. And that's what we intend to do, to be able to go out and argue that the justifiable reason that they are putting are not justifiable. Well, these amendments, Honorable Chair, that you're asking, strengthen implementation? The answer is yes. These amendments are going to strengthen implementation. How? One, the enforcement is going to be easier, streamlined, because the reports online are going to assess whether the employer has met their targets. You don't need an inspector to go and look at them. When you receive a report, the reports are going to be analyzed by the system, just like the SARS, when you submit your tax return, the system of SARS analyzes your return, the information that you gave SARS, and the system tells you immediately that you are going to get a return, a tax return of this amount, or you own SARS this amount, you must pay up. The same applies to the system that we're setting up. The system will be able to assess the compliance immediately, and the employer then will be able to get a certificate or not get a certificate as analyzed by the system, and inspectors will be able to enforce the law in those employers that have not met their target, and go out and do audit, what we call audit, for those employers who said they've got justifiable reasons for not complying with the law. Now, on the removal of the council on certification, the reason, I mean, that this law was this provision was put in 2018 on the law. From 2018 till now, the council has not been able to certify anything. Now, if we don't do something about this, it creates problems in the labor market, because then business says to us, look, we can't move. You've got a provision in the law that says the council must satisfy tests. The council is not capable of doing that. And how do we then carry on with our business? Now, any law that you put in place that is not implementable because of whatever reason, and we thought then the best thing is to remove this. There's nothing wrong in coming back later, a year, 2 years later, when the council says to us, we are able to do this work now. We've done all that we need to do. But since 2018 to now 2021, the council has not been able to do this. We don't think that they are likely. We've had a lot of discussion with them. They've conceded upfront that they won't be able to do this work. And they know that we're removing this. It's removed after discussion with them. Now, whether this removal then is going to make it difficult for employees and the delays in the labor court, unfortunately, yes, we concede that the courts, not only the courts, also the CCMA will have to come in and concentrate on those before they go to court. We hope that those disputes on whether the assessment is fair will be able to be decided at conciliation in the CCMA, and we'll have to interact with the labor court to see how can they move quick on this. But the most important issue is that if we don't have an avenue to provide this work, the labor market, then we are going to be accused of introducing legislation that is not implementable because the council has not got the capacity. And that's the reason that we've decided that we need to go this route. Otherwise, we would want to keep it if we can have confidence and clarity from the council that they'll be able to do it. But the council has indicated that they will not be able to do it. Yes, there's the unintended consequences of the delay that might happen in the labor court, but those are the issues that we need to deal with the presiding officer, the chief presiding officer in the labor court, to try and see how can we
has sought out the delivery time of the labor court in these kind of cases. The issue of people with disability, why are they not broken down in terms of race and gender? The problem here, Chair, the other race that the various groupings are broken down because we can get information from State South Africa. State South Africa are the only organization that publish the EAP, and the EAP, as they publish it, it does not have that breakdown of people with disability. That's the first problem. Therefore, even if we wanted to break it down on ourselves, then we should have then an EAP of people with disability. Even the EAP, we don't have EAP for people with disability. Even the target that you're going to set up, that we're setting it up, is not based on the EAP, because you don't have an EAP of how many people with disability are in the labor market. We don't have that. And now we're working on the target that was set by government long time ago, 2%. But that is not supported by any research through an EAP. And we've been engaging with State South Africa to see whether can we move on this issue and set up and they produce an EAP on people with disabilities, even if it's not broken down, at least we have something that we can work out on. As so far, they have not been able to do that. And the other issue, Chair, that we need to put on is that if you look at the numbers are very small. If you start breaking it down, it's going to be 0.0000005%. It's going to be really, the numbers are going to be very meaningless when you start breaking down at that level because of the low numbers. Those are the two reasons why we can't break it down, because we don't have the information from State South Africa in terms of both the EAP and that EAP to be broken down in terms of race, gender. And even if they do have it, even if they can produce it, because of the numbers, it might be the numbers that coming into the system are going to be very, very minimal. I mean, just if you can just think of how would you divide 2%, 1%, because now it's 1.3% in a company, and what percentage are you going to get the numbers there? And those are the issues that we took into consideration. But we're continuing having this discussion with State South Africa to see what is it that we need to do to convince them to produce an EAP for people with disability. The issue around about professionally qualified and private schools, this law applies to all sectors of the economy, including private schools. As long as if this bill is passed, as long as they employ more than 50 employees. If they employ less than 50, then it won't apply to them, this section of the law, the affirmative action part of the law, it won't apply to them. But if they employ more than 50, it will apply. But presently, as we speak now, this law applies to them also, irrespective of their size in terms of the issues that we've raised. Will this improve representativity at different levels? We think that if we enforce and apply the way that we think it should be, yes, it will. It should improve this. And we've already in the interaction with the different sectors seen how they see this issue and why some of them are very reluctant in going this route, because it's going to expose them in terms of the enforcement. The Section 53, first, and as we've indicated, Section 53 was not operationalized because when the law came into operation, the debates were what would be compliance? Will compliance be employer that report? If an employer submit a report, does that mean compliance? Then they must get a certificate, they must do business with government. Now that we're making these changes in Section 53, those changes enable us then to confidently apply Section 53 because it worked out
what is it that we need to do to apply Section 53. It does not change the requirement that says that if you do not comply with the law, you are not going to have the right to do business with the state. If the minister does not give you a certificate, you have not complied with the target, you have not reported our discussion in the law, then you should not be able to do business with government. That has not been changed. What has been changed is that we've introduced steps that need to be taken for a company to get the certificate so that it can do business with the government. And that's the change that we're making in this. We're not doing away with that requirement, Chief. I think I've dealt with all the questions, Chief. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mkalipi. I don't know if members have follow-up questions. Just one, which I maybe it was part of the list of questions I had. I don't know how I missed it. I just wanted to check where, with regard to the South African Human Rights Commission, whether the department has taken into account the issues that they raised in the report and in amending this particular legislation.
The issue that the human rights raised in that report is that employment equity, affirmative action should not be about race and gender. It should be about the need, basically. Anybody that, if I remember the statement that was made some time ago by one of leaders, the issue, if you've got poor white men, therefore they should benefit on the affirmative action. Presently, the law talk on those who were previously disadvantaged, and it defines designated grouping as African, women, people with disability, and those. But the report says no, do away with that separation. Everybody should be able to benefit on affirmative action. That's what the report says. Now, we had a discussion with the Human Rights Commission. They agree with us that this report was for discussion and debate, and it's not a policy statement that says employment equity is unconstitutional. That's why the Constitutional Court rejected it, the Labour Court and Labour Appeal Court rejected this. Therefore, we could not take those issues, because remember, we went to court precisely to challenge that approach in terms of the report. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mkalipi, for the responses. I see that there are no follow-up questions from members. The next stage then was to advertise the bill for public comments and submission. But I think we will wait for the, I suggest that Ms. Isaac, if we could get a written advice on this issue of Section 42, so that we consider it in the committee next week on Tuesday before the advert goes out, both to the media and also to the website of Parliament. Can you agree on that, Ms. Isaac?
Yes, Chair.
That's in order. Okay. No, thank you very much. We now come to deal with the COIDA. Mr. Mafata, over to you. Compensation for Occupational Injuries and Diseases Amendment Bill.
Commissioner, may I go ahead?
Oh, okay. No, sorry, I thought that on our quarterly list initially, that was Mr. Mkalipi and Mr. Mafata who will be attending the meeting. So I just assumed that therefore the presentation. So no, I'm sorry. So you can go ahead, Mr. Mkalipi. Yeah.
The commissioner will do the hard part. He will answer all the questions.
Oh, okay.
I will do the easy part. Thank you, Chair. The purpose of this deal, Chair, is the Compensation for Occupational Income Disease Amendment is amending the present Compensation Act that we have of 1993. And these amendments seek to expand, as the Minister has already indicated, the coverage of occupational injuries and diseases to previous excluded vulnerable workers, as well as improvement of compensation benefits to employees. This is done by removing the exclusion of domestic workers from the definition of employees. As the honorable members know, that the current act now defines in the definition of employees, that definition excludes domestic workers. And the members would know that there was a constitutional court judgment on this issue. And this change is just to ensure that the law is in line with the decision of the court. And these amendments seek to link to key targets, Chapter 10 and 11 of the National Development Plan of Government, and align the Act with the requirements of other legislation so that we can remove any ambiguity and the misunderstanding in some of the provision of the Act. And we want to make it easy for administration of the fund so that we remove the DG to do administration work. So the OG will remain having overall responsibility of the fund, but the compensation should be able to do most of the administrative work and carry the commission forward in terms of this area. Therefore, the amendments are there with, in some sections, removing the DG and replacing the DG with a compensation of commission in some sectors of section of the Act. Next slide, please. It also, the Act empowers NEDLAC to nominate a representative on the board, just like is done in other board representatives. They must nominate and provide the minister with a nominated representative, so the minister should then appoint from business and labor, and the state obviously represented. The bill will provide terms of office of board members to be limited to 2 terms of service. It will provide for disqualification of members from the board or resignation or removal. It will introduce rehabilitation, which is a very important issue. Is when people got injured at work, and the employer should be able to do whatever possible to rehabilitate those people who are injured at work, so that they can go back to work again and be productive members of society, instead of having to stay at home. In terms of, as I've said, introduce rehabilitation, reintegration, and return to work in order to address the tendency of some employers to dismiss employees on the basis of the occupational injuries and diseases. And to decriminalize COIDA by replacing criminal sanctions with administrative fines. The major problem, Chair, is with the sum of the contravention. If somebody gets injured at work, or if a company does not submit a report. Now, remember, this is COIDA. This is not occupational health and safety. It's different. It's about payment. If an employer does not submit a report, should we put a criminal case on that? Why not just fine the employer, because these are administrative fines? And that's what we're trying to do, to streamline, where we don't need to burden the criminal justice system with court cases that are not necessary. That should not necessarily go to the criminal justice system. It should be done through administrative fines, and the people who are affected and who feel that they've been underdone, they can then go to court on this and challenge those fines. Next slide, please. Now, clause one of the amendment seeks to amend section one of the Act, which amends the definition of assessment by linking the assessment of employees to the new section that requires employee rehabilitation after injury on duty, to amend the definition of dependent employees to include life partners, As you know, members, we live in a constitutional state, and our law and the constitution regards partners not only as those who are married in the Western style of marriage. There's also traditional style of marriage, and there's partnership, people that are sitting together, taking a conscious decision to sit, to stay together. They should be able to be included in the definition. Partners of employees, of the employee, in the definition to limit the age of children who are able to claim dependence benefit to 25 years. And this is far more than what dependent in the labor market is understood. Because when you are 18, in terms of other legislation, you are able then to transact. And some of them, when you are 21, you can vote when you are 18. When you are 21, you can, if there was money put aside for you in the guardian fund, you can access that money now because you are an adult. Because this deals with vulnerability and people who are injured, if employees and their children are being supported by the fund, we are limiting that to 25 years more than any other definition that separates whether you're an adult, you're able to stand on your own and work on your own. So we want to amend the definition of earnings to link it to the Income Tax Act, amend the definition of an employee to remove any the exclusion of domestic employee from the definition, which seek to solve the unfair problem of excluding domestic workers, as I've already indicated, insert definition of rehabilitation of workers to facilitate their integration and return to work after injuries and disease. Next slide, please. Clause 2, seek to amend Section 4 by inserting an additional function for the Commission in dealing with claims to enable the Commissioner to introduce forms and other requisite documents that are needed to obtain for conversation. And clause 3 seeks to amend Section 11 by substituting Section 1 to make it clear that the chairperson of the board must be independent and that the board members must be appointed through a transparent network process. Clause 5 and 6 prescribe the terms of office of board, the disqualification of board members, and the resignation and removal of members of the board from office. Presently, the fund is can be chaired by even a government employee, and this clause is trying to solve all those problems. Clause 8, this clause seeks to amend Section 16 of the Act by adding a subsection to enable the payment of costs for representation by and payment of board members, the commissioner and staff from the budget of the compensation fund. Clause 12 seeks to amend Section 22 by adding additional subsection that clarifies when conveyance commences and ceases. This will eliminate unnecessary dispute on claim, e.g. conveyance, which will commence at a spot designated by the employer for pickup and cease at a stop spot designated by the employer to drop off. Conveyance can be by any mode of transport. Now, members know that in sectors like agriculture, construction, employers provide sometimes transport that pick up employees from a certain point and drop them to another point. Now, this is trying to clarify this, when are they covered by the Act in terms of benefits. That's what this is trying to clarify. Clause 16 seeks to amend Section 8 of the Act by substituting mutual section with licensee is to end the monopoly that is associated with the mutual association. Presently, the law says that the fund can only transact with this certain mutual association. Red Mutual and them is naming them in the law. Now, to open this space for competition and other mutual associations, the law, the section is amended. Clause 18 seeks to amend Section 36 of the Act so that the fund can no longer claim from REF what is paid to claim it in instances where the employees are involved in accidents on the public road. These employees will be entitled to claim from road fund and REF verify with the fund if the same claim has not been received, will assist to avoid double dipping. What it means is that if you are in a public road, you are in an accident, there is a fund that is set up to compensate you for that. If you are in your car from the parliamentary village, you're traveling to parliament, you get injured in an accident, in that the fund, the road accident fund, must pay, not the compensation. Clause 21, 6 to amend section 41 of the Act by inserting a subsection to provide for employees who independently obtain a medical report with a right to claim for a refund from the commission for the cost of such a medical report. If an employee goes and gets a medical report and pays, and that employee should be able to claim the funds back. Clause 36 to amend section 49 to provide for the review of pension claims every 24 months for reassessment, payment, disablement. If certain classification, the date on which the pension shall commence, there are current pension cases where the pensioners have fully recovered from their permanent disablement but continue to receive multiple pensions. Some of them are even engaged in active gainful employment with hazardous. Now, not only those, I mean, if the fund gives you a pension and after some time it is find out that the pension that they've given you is not enough, you should be able to come back and ask for a review and ask the fund to look at it. Therefore, if the fund can do that, it should be able also to do the same if you are well now, you are working, you've been rehabilitated, instead of continuing paying for you. Clause 13, seek to amend section 21. Your support, yes, next one, please. Sorry, ma'am. Clause 41, seek to insert chapter Roman figure A in the Act in order to provide for rehabilitation. We've already indicated this reintegration and the return of work. This is included in that chapter to address the tendency of some employers to dismiss employees, as we indicated, if they are injured. We want to make sure that employers spend time and the cost of this is at the fund cost, not at the employer. And chapter Roman figure B11A seeks to introduce the concept of multidisciplinary employee-based process of rehabilitation. And this means that an employer must exhaust all rehabilitation and reintegration processes before laying off their employees. Employers will be incentivized for full compliance with provision of this chapter by way of rebate on their annual assessment. Or if the employer spend money on these issues, they can then be able to get rebate, that means deduction from what they were supposed to have paid the fund. Next slide, please. Now, clause 43, I mean, this was a very controversial clause, honorable members on this. This was a clause that created all the fight when the bill was published. This clause seeks to amend section 73 of the Act to expressly provide for the reopening of claims after the expire of 2 years from the date of accident, as the first one. Then clause 43 also inserts subsection 73.4, which seeks to provide that only third parties who are registered with the compensation fund would be allowed to transact with the fund, and only under the condition prescribed by the minister. The members will see in the bill that is in front of them that there's a provision for registration. The original bill that was presented in Parliament in the postal committee was intended to remove third parties altogether so that the fund interact directly with this client. But with the discussion in the fund, in the committee, the bill was amended to include the provision that all these third parties must register with the fund. Clause 57 seeks to amend section 90 of the Act to provide for variation of decision instead of using the word review on this, because this is not about the review, it's about if a decision is made in error, we need to be able to vary that decision and make it easy to vary that decision. And variation in order to distinguish the internal review process under this section from the judicial process to align it with the LRA. As members will know, in the LRA, the CCMA can has got powers to vary its decision. If it's made a wrong decision, they can vary that decision, but they cannot review their own decision. Only the labor court can review their decision. Clause 59 seeks to set to ensure that compliance with the Act by providing for the appointment of inspectors who will specify deal with all quota non-compliance issues. Inspectors have the power to inspect, question, and issue compliance orders, which will eventually be made orders of court, but no answer given by any person during this process in relation to the inspection shall be admissible as evidence. Next slide, please. Clause 66 to amend Section 87 to authorize the Minister to make regulation regarding the following additional matter: rehabilitation, reintegration, re-return to work, inspection, compliance, enforcement, determination, and calculation of permanent disablement, and appointment of assessor, presiding officer, and in a printer. Clause 61 seeks to amend Section 99 by proposing to substitute offenses and fines for administrative penalties in the following sections: 89, 40, 47, 64, 68, 81, 82, and 83. Next slide, please. The amendments have been discussed at NETLEC and approved at NETLEC. The draft amendment has been noted by the Minister. It has been tabled to Cabinet and approved, granted for public comment and consultation. Public comments were conducted. The Department received public comments. The Department complied and compiled and reported on the public comments to NETLEC and the Minister and incorporated all the public comments in the metrics and considered them, enacted the provision made on the metrics that the Department found to be relevant as commented by the public. The enacted provision were incorporated both in the report and NETLEC metrics. The bill was tabled before Cabinet for approval for introduction in Parliament, and it was subsequently introduced in Parliament and referred and deliberated by the Social Committee on Labour. The committee considered and deliberated on the daily basis before referring to this committee. The bill has been engaged and tagged as a 75 bill in terms of the Constitution. Next slide, please. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mukhalifi. Can I just caution honorable members that the assistant church members can they refrain from attacking one another on the church? Please, can we be civil in the meeting?
Honorable
Chair. Honorable Bishop.
Thank you very much. I do not think that is suffice. I do not take lightly to being attacked by an official. It is not her place to do so, and I expect an apology. Thank you.
Sorry, which official?
Who is Pinky Malloy?
Oh, the Deputy Minister.
Okay, I do not take lightly to what she is saying about the department addressing us and presenting to us and saying to me, do you still expect us to overemphasize on what we have presented? That is not a way for a minister to speak to a member of any committee, and I expect her apology. Thank you.
Honorable Chair, I don't think it's a matter to apologize for, because there was a question on this chat by honorable member who made mention of why is that members of the ruling party are so lackluster in attending meetings. And I asked, we are still in attendance, thank you. And I just said that, but the conversation continued, Chair, and I explained that maybe the issue is that I didn't say I'm because I joined in another with another gadget. I explained that Honorable Boshoff, we are as a department presenting to the select committee, and the minister has made the opening remarks. Our officials are presenting to the select committee and responding to all the queries, all your queries and concerns, which means all the queries and concerns of the committee. Chair, and I was saying that the committee, do you still expect us as a department to talk while all the officials are presenting to the committee? This is what I'm requesting. I was asking, what are we supposed to speak, or are we too silent that we have to make to speak when the department is presenting? I'm speaking on behalf of the department because I'm part of the department, Honorable Chairperson. I don't think I'm out of order on this matter. Thank you.
Okay.
Honorable Chair, I would like to speak before because the discussion was between myself and Dango, Honorable Dango, and then the Honorable Minister or Deputy Minister, whatever she may be, came in, and I do not take lightly to that. So I have no idea what she's trying to say by overemphasizing on what we have presented. I didn't ask for any more questions, nothing. And I think it's very, very low of her to come in with something like that. Somebody in her position that's not expected of.
Can I request that we should not be distracted? We having a presentation, the two presentations on
Sorry, Chair, this is an attack on a member of the opposition. I asked, why is it that the ANC members of the Select Committee are not on this platform? Why is it that they get away with it? And then she comes in, or she's trying to say that this is why she's saying what she is saying. Why are the ANC members not here? Why must we correlate for them?
Well, I don't want, that's why I'm saying I don't want us to get bogged down discussing, because I see now the other members who are raising their hands, and we might not focus on the issue or the business of the day. So I want to request if there are any concerns, they be raising in other platforms other than the committee. If any of you is offended by the other members, I would suggest that the matter be raised up with the chief whip or the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. I just want to make that request so that we don't have the discussions on whether the ANC members are not doing our work by not attending, because others will come in and then we end up discussing the issue of attendance by parties. So I want to request that if you still feel offended, Mr. Oshoff or Mr.
Honorable Chair, you're protecting your members and you're not protecting me at all.
No. I'm not here about protecting anyone. What I'm saying is that the matter must be elevated at other forums. You can make a formal complaint to the chairperson of the NCOP or to the chief whip or to the member or to the leader of your party. So that I don't want us to end up discussing this issue. I want us to discuss the issue, the business of the day, so that we don't get distracted by the other issues. So that's why I'm saying anyone, not only yourself, anyone who feels offended can take up with the relevant authority the matter. Thank you very much, Honorable Member. Can I ask the... Let me just check, because I know it's no longer... Mr. Mane, you want to make any comment on the presentation?
Good afternoon, Professor and Honorable Members. Chair, I do not have any comment at the moment. I am covered by Mr. Mkhalipi,
okay.
And I will also just follow discussions of the committee henceforth. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Mr. Raya? The office of the...
No.
Chairperson.
I have no comments at this stage, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. No, thank you very much. Any questions or comments, honourable members, on the presentation on COIDA? Honourable Shaw, followed by Honourable Moimam, in that order for now.
Honourable Chair, thank you very much.
No,
I would like to know whether the regulation preventing medical service providers from ceding their claims to third-party pre-funders for payment by the fund. I know that this regulation was challenged by the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Labour and the offending clause was removed. I now understand they have again republished it on the 19th of October, calling for a 60-day period of public comment. I never picked up anything about that in the presentation. If I missed it, I apologize. But if I could just be given an answer on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. What's up? Honorable Maima.
Thank you, Chair. Just starting to you on the amendment to Section 84, that speaks to exemption of certain employers from assessment. If more details can be given on that. What will be the areas that the Director General could, in concurrence with the Minister, exempt the employers from payment of assessment? What could be the factors that has to be taken into account? The second one relates to the assertion put forward to say part of the amendment including section 39 to 83 is to avoid burdening the court with the litigation. In essence, it is decriminalizing the what was intended to be a criminal offense in an event of non-compliance or contravention. What experience could be relayed to that could have informed the department to make a comparison between criminalizing a contravention that has burdened the department. I'm more concerned about the impact of this. Whether by so doing, are we not giving a free ride to the employers to contravene quota? Is it not possible to rather include both criminalizing and also an option that is proposed in the amendment to these sections? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mimak. Are there any other questions from other honorable members? Or is it follow up from members that have already asked questions? Not. Maybe let me also, because I was also concerned with this issue of administrative fines and not wanting to decriminalize. I don't know if perhaps, I know we're not discussing, we're not putting our position now because we're not deliberating now, we're just asking questions on the issue that Honorable Moimang is asking whether we could not do the vote of them, maybe. Step by step, maybe start with these administrative fines, but if there's no compliance, and then you get to, rather than leaving it to the employer, if the employer is not satisfied with the administrative fine, and then he or she has an option to go to court, but you don't give the same to the commissioner. To do the same if employers are not complying even after having been given funds. I'm taking into account other funds in other labor laws where we have just paid the fines but not complying, but also the delays with the statutory cases, for example. So I was also thinking along those lines, if we should not rather, or what has been as the experience with the situation currently, now that the act has not yet been amended. The other question I'm having, Mr. Mkalipe, if you go to section one under the in the definition, section 1F, but there's a further subsection F, which says a child who is 25 years or older, a parent, a brother, a sister, a half-brother or half-sister, grandparent, a grandchild, or any other person, and who was in the opinion of a commissioner at the time of the employee's death, wholly or partly financially depend on the employee. There's this part which says, provided there is no widow or widower as referred to in paragraph A, or a person as referred to in paragraph C and E, or a child as referred in paragraph. If I can just get clarity on that, because the impression, maybe I may be wrong, that's why I need clarity. The impression I'm getting is that this person who's over 25 or older, I mean he's 25 or older, may not therefore get any money if there's a widow or widower, if I can just get clarity on that. So that those are just the two issues that I wanted to ask. The third one, I think you responded to it while you were making the presentation on the rehabilitation, because I was going to ask about the financial capacity of the fund, if they have to pay for rehabilitation as well. But you responded to it before I asked the question that the employer will be paying, but it will then get a rebate. So that one has been then addressed. Thank you very much. If we can get responses. I don't know where Honorable Basofi is follow up on your part or the old hand. Okay. All right. Mr. Mkalipi and Mr. Mafata.
Commissioner,
thank you, Chair. Thank you, Honorable Chair, Honorable Member. I am with my colleague, Mr. Herima Pulukhela, who is going to also assist in responding to some of the questions. I've just touched on a few of them. So, the first one, there is no regulation that the Minister has issued in terms of corridor that seeks to prohibit or ban third parties. What the fund has issued is a notice prescribing or notifying stakeholders of the intention to prohibit payment of claims to accounts other than those of the claimant. And as part of the process, we then issued out the notice to get views of the stakeholders so that we can take those into account in making a final decision. Going to the other question, the first question from Honorable Moyeman around the Section 84. So now, the Section 84 quota prescribes the circumstances under which the employer can be exempt from assessment, and these are national and provincial governments or employees that are employed in the national and provincial spheres of government, and also the employees that are employed in the local authorities, in the municipalities, provided such municipalities can then keep security sufficient to cover incidents where they don't have sufficient cover to cover their employees. And also there may also be instances where employees or employers may seek to obtain a similar policy provided by either a mutual association, Rand Mutual or FEM, which then has to be approved by the DG before such an employer can seek to get, and also it can be proved by the mutual that they do indeed have such a policy cover for the employer. So those are the circumstances under which exemptions. And in such instances, then what it means is that the fund will receive the claim adjudicated, but the honoring of the claim and the payment would be by the employer concerned. In the case of government officials, it will then be paid through the government pensions administration agency. And in the case of municipalities, it will be based on the insurance arrangements that we have with the insurers, or if they self-insure, it will then be paid by the municipality itself. The issue around, and I'm sure Mr. Mambokhera will also touch on this, so the issue around the decriminalizing the non-compliance to COILA and reducing administrative penalties, I think the overall objective of enforcing compliance is to make sure that at the end of the day, there is compliance by employer, whether is it with regard to submitting returns and being assessed, or whether when it comes to complying with submission of claims or reporting claims when employees are injured. Now, one of the challenges that we had is that for inspectors to be able to enforce this, if it's criminalized, it falls outside the processes as prescribed in the Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which is the act that empowers or gives the inspectors the authority to inspect the workplaces. And it proves difficult because at the end of the day, we end up not achieving what we're intending to achieve with enforcing compliance, which is getting the employer to comply, but rather subjecting the process to a criminal process which may or may not appear before the courts for a prolonged period of time. Meanwhile, the person who's dependent on the employer compliance may not be assisted. So administrative penalties and fines then are able to assist us and are making it easier for inspectors to be able to enforce compliance in terms of the provisions of the BCA. Maybe just one thing before I give rehabilitation, Chair. So what the cost of the clinical rehabilitation is covered by the compensation fund. The rebate that the employers would enjoy would be in instances where they participate in the rehabilitation process by assisting with the employee to return to work through vocational rehabilitation and also making sure that they then retain the employee in the workplace after they've gone through a period of rehabilitation, and they've also then created reasonable accommodation for the employee to be able to still continue working in the employer's employ, be it in the same capacity or in a different capacity that now that the employee would have been trained in as part of the rehabilitation process. And that's the merit rebate would then be the incentives to incentivize employers to participate actively in the full multidisciplinary rehabilitation of the employees. I'll just hand over to Ms. Mapulu and have questions. Thank you. Proceed and then respond to those.
Okay. I was worried because I didn't get the name of the person that you were referring to.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Then you can continue if he's not responding.
So, thank you, Chair. So, question one, it just clarifies that in an instance where, so we're trying to, currently the limit on beneficiaries is up to the age of 18 years. And only beyond 18 years in instances where the child beneficiary can prove that he or she is still in school. And this then has to be renewed on an annual basis. So we basically have then increased that to the age of 25 so that any person who was a child dependent on the injured worker who is now deceased is enjoying cover. But in instances where there is a widow, the benefits are paid to the widower.
and there are some benefits also that are then, because what the pension payout is shared between the widow as well as the children dependent who are in the who depended on the injured worker for support. So in the amendment to Section 1F, we're just trying to clarify it and make it a bit more explicit in terms of who qualifies and who gets the benefits. Thank you, Chair. I hope I've responded to all the questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Mafate. Are there any follow-up questions, honorable members?
One last question from my side.
Yes, okay, you can go ahead, honorable member.
On the access, there's a chapter that speaks to the appointment of inspectors, and there's more elaboration in terms of the purpose. But the concern that I have is that the act, the bill still leaves the employer with the discretion whether to allow the inspectors or not, because it speaks to the inspectors have the power to enter homes and hopefully subject to the consent from the occupier or the owner to enforce compliance with the act. Didn't the department consider amending this, or is it linked to other related constitutional provision like the right to privacy? Because my view is there are instances where employers in the past have refused the inspector's access to their site, and this came at the expense of the very vulnerable and marginalized workers that you are trying to protect. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Maima. Are there any other members who want to make follow-up questions? Responses, please.
Can I have Commissioner this? On this issue of access, what is important, Honorable Member, is that we must differentiate between an employer who's refusing access, in that inspectors have got the right. They can go to the police and get access if the employer is refusing. But if an employer says, you want access, but because of these following reasons today, maybe we had a breakdown of machinery. We are just too busy trying to solve this today. Can you come next week in this? It's not a refusal, and the employer gives you reason. Therefore, we put in a position that enable us and the inspector to be flexible. And we accept that if an employer refuses exception entry, and also remember, if you want to go into the employer, the employer must allow you in, because the employer is responsible for your safety and your protection when you are in the employer's premises. And the employer must be able to guide you going in. That's the reason that that section is written on that way. And it differentiates between an employer who's refusing an inspector entry and an employer who's discussing with an inspector and saying, because of the following reason, we are not going to be able to do it. It could be that there was flood in that area. The inspector wanted to go in. There was flood, raining, there was rain during that week, and the company is busy trying to clear that out. They are not going to be able to deal with the issue the inspector wanted to do. And they give that as a reason, and the inspector could see, and he knows that there was that such rain that took place during that period. And that's the issue, that's how that section deals with this issue. There was also the question that was asked about assessment, exemptions on assessment. I think one of the members should think about domestic employers. Now, if the fund is going to ask domestic employers for assessment and to assess their liability to the fund, we're talking about a million domestic employers whose wages are very low, wages that are paid. I mean, they pay maybe the minimum wage, or even domestic workers don't work the full week. Some of them work 2 days, or one day a week. And then those are the areas that the commissioner would be able to exempt employers from exemption, or if for assessment, terms of assessment, or it could be any other reasons that the employer is reasonable. I mean, the most important issue is that there should be a reasonable justification for exemption of assessment. The commissioner can exempt a sector. I've made an example of a domestic sector. I just don't think that it's going to be possible for the fund to do assessment for all domestic employers. The fund has got to come up with another arrangement in dealing with this. It might mean that a domestic sector employers could be exempted, but that's a decision of the commissioner that the commissioner would make. That's the reason that clause is put in. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Khalif. I take it that there are no further questions, honorable members. I don't know the DG, if you want to say something, it must be your mic is open.
No, I think Mr. Mkhaliki has covered what I was going to say. I was also going to use the example of a government, for instance, is an exempted employer. It just makes life much more easier administratively. Does it mean that government employees do not enjoy the benefit covered by the Compensation Act? No. There's budget that has been put aside for that. So the fact that they're exempted doesn't necessarily mean that the workers in that area are going to be worse off. In as far as that is concerned. The second point I wanted to raise, just to add to what Mr. Khalif was saying about the inspectors, the way this provision has been put, it's put in such a way that it doesn't say the inspector should get permission from the employer. It says in consultation with the employer. So the inspector can still use his discretion based on some of the reasons that Mr. Khalid has mentioned, and say the situation is such that you are unable to come in and do an inspection. So it's been made in such a way that it also empowers an inspector to make up his or her mind in terms of what the situation is. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, DG. I think at this stage, then I'll allow the Deputy Minister to make closing remarks.
No, thank you, Honorable Chair. I think we have said all what we wanted to say to the committee, and I think from our side, we are trying to provide all the necessary information that the select committee would want, and we are doing this at the best of our abilities to make sure we provide truthful information and what we have done, the work that we have done as a department. And I don't think there's any intention from our part to mislead the portfolio, the select committee. We are here to work with you, and we are trying all our best to make sure that all what the select committee wants, we provide, and we make sure that we meet all the necessary and relevant requirements that are supposed to be given to yourself. And we have no intention also of misleading the select committee on the information that we have gathered. And as we always say, Honorable Chairperson, that all what we do it bona fide, with no malafide. So we do everything with good intentions. And if any you are not satisfied at all, I'm sure, yes, we agree that there are other processes that you can follow. And I want to take this opportunity to thank you, Chair, for giving us this opportunity as a department to come and present to you, and humbly so thank also all the officials led by the DG, and also thank the Minister in absentia for having opened this meeting with input. And we are ready, Honorable Chair, at any given moment when you need
us to come and clarify ourselves and put things into perspective, we'll do so at your convenient time. Thank you so much for this opportunity, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister, and also thanks to the Minister for coming, also the opening remarks and the closing remarks, and your participation in the meeting. Thanks to the Honorable Members of the Committee for your attendance and participation. DG, Mr. Mkalipi, Mr. Mafata, and other officials of the department, thank you very much. In terms of the process now, as I was indicating earlier, will be the issue advert on the bill for the public to make their comments. But we're dealing with this bill towards the end of the year. It will mean, therefore, we'll again deal with the bill next year, 2022. We will use this period, the November-December period, for the advert and also getting the submissions from the public, the input from the public, which we will then consider when we come back from the recess in 2022. So that is going to be the process, but as soon as we also get the NCOP program for term 1 of 2022, we'll also develop our committee program, which will indicate as to when we are going to have the public hearings, then also the other processes, deliberations, clause by clause, and then the adoption of the report. Yeah, all those processes will be able to have a clear way forward once we receive the NCOP program for term 1 of 2022. Thank you very much, Honorable Members. We're not going to deal with the minutes this evening because of a problem of quorum. We need to be five provinces to adopt the minutes who are less than five. So we defer the minutes to the next meeting. Thank you very much, everybody. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chair.
The recording stopped.
Thank you
very much. Good night.